So this is one of the most exciting times of a monk's life, to see what questions are coming up today. Heaps of them as well. Now let's get in here. Number one is it possible to experience a nimitta without experiencing any feelings of bliss and rapture? Yeah, you can, but it's not going to be very helpful. It is the bliss and the rapture, the joy, which is the glue which draws your attention into the experience. And if you have got nothing to draw it in, you tend to push yourself onto it, which disturbs the whole thing. So it's important to develop the bliss and the joy of the mind. It's there, and that which I'd said this morning about smiling at your nimitta, and your nimitta smiles back. It's a very, very good technique. Or doing loving kindness towards your nimitta. And then nimitta becomes beautiful. And once it starts to become beautiful and joyful, then you can do something with it. Otherwise, it will just disappear. It will become boring. So, if you can develop the joy of the nimitta, then it's very easy to go deeper, and you have a great time. Could you please explain how anumodana, passing of merits, works? That was actually for a couple of days ago. I never got around to it. We always do anumodana to all devas. Sattvas, that's animals, Buddhas, ghosts, and all deceased family and friends. How can they benefit from it? I think I'm not quite sure if I mentioned that, but anumodana means literally to rejoice, that's modana, and anu, along with. So what you do, you ask the devas, Buddhas, your friends who are not here, to rejoice along with what you're doing. Say, I'm having a good time, you should be proud of me, you have a good time as well. And you know that, especially if it's a relation, somebody close to you, that if there's... Actually, we'll do this experiment just to prove this at the end of this retreat. I usually do it every year. We do a loving kindness meditation towards the end of the retreat. And when you've got lots of metta really coming up strong, and then I usually tell you, think of somebody, you know, pretty close to you who's not here. They could be the other side of the world. Think of them now and zap them with metta. Really get in there and just bathe them, blast them with this beautiful, warm, loving kindness. Oh, I really want you to be happy and well. My whole being goes out for you to support you in your joy and your bliss. And when you get into it like that, at that time you're already doing it, but I always look at my clock and I note down the time. And at the end of the retreat, I tell you, at that moment you blasted your friends with loving kindness. Now when you go home, give them a call and ask them, at that time, what was happening? Don't ask leading questions and see what happens. And when I do this, always in the evening, I get a couple of calls coming through. Ajahn Brahm, it worked. Try it, find out for yourself. What happens is that you ask them, what were you doing about sort of, you know, 2:10 or something? Really strange you asked me. I was actually thinking of you. I felt so nice and felt so good. I was really worried, but then suddenly, why did you ask that question? And it's amazing. It does actually work. You can contact someone a long way away, especially if you've got a deep meditation and you're getting some strength coming up and you send like loving kindness, and they can feel it. There's an effect there, even though they may be, you know, off in London or New York somewhere. You can try it. It does work. And you also know it works if you're in trouble. If you are in a car accident and your mother on the other side of the world, she knows that something's up. One of the stories, right, this was actually published in the Melbourne Age when I was visiting Melbourne a couple of years ago. And there was a vet, an animal doctor, who was just finished work on a Friday evening and he was going into the countryside of Victoria for a weekend party with his friends. He was a single guy, lots of girls there, lots of friends there, he was having a really nice time, really looking forward to this great party. So he got in his car, he had his bag already packed, straight after work, off up the surgery, in the car, and went off to the country home. And halfway on the journey, he actually wrote this and sent it up to the Melbourne Age, and they printed the whole article. Halfway on the journey, he was overcome with his immense emotions. And he couldn't help himself. He started to feel really, really sad. And it was so strong, he realized it was impairing his driving. He had to pull off to the side of the road and just started weeping, crying his eyes out. And he did not know why. Where did that come from? And it took him about a quarter of an hour, half an hour, I don't know exactly the details, to get himself together again, to stop crying, so he could actually drive again. And so he drove, and when he got to the country house, he found out the reason. There was a message waiting for him there. At precisely that time, his dog had been run over and killed. And he said it was no way could he have known that, but he felt it. His dearly, dear dog, which he loved so much, had been killed in that moment. Fascinating that these things happen. There's one of the monks over in Sydney, I won't say who it is, but as a young kid, it was actually a layperson in Sydney, one of the disciples there. As a young kid, he literally did run away with the circus. You know, that's a joke almost, you run away with the circus, but he did it. There was a circus in town, and he wasn't having a good time at school, so he decided to join the circus, and there he's apprenticed to the elephant trainer. So he was looking after the elephants as they went from place to place. I forget which circus it was, one of the big ones in Australia. And he said that one day he was taking the elephant, he was actually with the elephant trailer, from one sort of venue to another venue, and the elephant went ballistic, started, you know, trumpeting in the trailer, in the float, stamping his feet. They had to stop and calm the elephant down. And they don't know what spooked the elephant. They couldn't actually tell. It was only later on they found out the head train who'd gone on ahead had a fatal accident. You know, if you were actually the head trainer of, you know, an animal in a circus, you are so close to those beings. And his head trainer had died, and the elephant, at exactly that time, just went completely out of his mind and had to take a long time to calm him down. When you're close to something, like an animal or a sort of a fellow human being, then there is that connection. So imagine that if you think of somebody now, even if they're dead, and it's somebody you're very, very close to, and you actually concentrate on them, you sustain your attention on them. You don't just, you know, think of their name, but you really do it properly. Then they'll know that you're thinking of them. There'll be a connection there. And then you start giving all this beautiful energy of loving kindness. You really wish them well. All the goodness which I've done on this retreat is for you. And my father who looked after me for such a long time. And if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. You think of them and you give them all that merit. That's how it gets there. They know. May not know specifically, but they get the feeling. And they get happy. You've transferred your happiness to them. It's very easy to understand how it works. That makes sense? That's how it works, so you can always do that. Especially if it's someone very close to you. It's much easier the closer they are to you. Yeah?
You mentioned your father, so are you talking even about
people who are dead? They're dead, yeah. Sure. I mean, obviously the more distant they are, both in time and in the life place, the life forms, the harder it is. And if it's someone, you know, who you've been with recently, but they haven't died a long, long time ago, it's much more difficult to contact them because, you know, the separation, the emotional bond is weakened through time. So if it's a child or a father who's died a long time ago, it's much harder. But if it's someone who's died very recently, then there's still a very strong bond. And they can feel that. And you can feel it. Okay, the next question. Please tell us more about nimittas. What are they? In what ways do they manifest? How precisely can they be used to bring us into jhana? I don't know if this was yesterday's question, but I think I talked a lot about nimittas this morning. But there are other different types of nimittas. I already mentioned, I think, in passing the firework nimittas, you're sitting there and these flashes of light come up, but they don't really last. There is the distant pinpoint nimitta. It's like a very tiny little light in the distance over there. That's actually quite a nice one, because if you just keep focus on that and just allow your mind to go into it, it starts to expand. It can be a really nice nimitta. There are the nimittas that you see rolling fields, and you see monks, and you see Buddhas, and that's all really great stuff. It's very fascinating, but it's a complete waste of time because it's too complicated. If you do get one of those nimittas of actually scenery, which is very complex, Again, one of the tricks to turn that into a useful nimitta, which will take you into deep meditation, in other words, to simplify it, say you're seeing like a pasture scene. Take a blade of grass or take a leaf, the one which is the most beautiful, the most deep green. Just focus on that. And then that will sort of fill up the whole image of the mind and you've got this beautiful green nimitta. Whatever it is, try not to go to complexity, go to simplicity. Because the more complex the nimitta is, the more things are going on there, the more it's disturbing the mind. It shows your mind is complex, hasn't got that unity which is required for the deeper meditations. But you can still use those complex nimittas, just focus on one simple thing. And that might very easily turn into a simple nimitta. So it's good fun with these things. And another thing I was talking to people earlier on, that when you start to get close to these nimitta things, your mind starts to get very, very strong. And your mind can actually play around. It's fun to allow the mind to play around. I call it, it's allowing the perception to grow its wings. So it can start to do things it's not supposed to do. In other words, you see perceptions, you're seeing it and it does not make any sense. You see the wall dissolve. It starts to melt. The bricks start to drip. Or you start feel your body just filling up the whole room. Or one of the first things that happened to me that in my early years as a monk, I was passing the washing line and I saw someone. That's actually one of the first things which really, you know, shook me. I saw someone had put a black towel on the line. It was jet black. And I thought, that's really strange, because if you go in Myers or Coles, you never see black towels being sold. You know, you have pink towels, white towels, yellow towels, red towels, blue towels, but not black towels. Well, this is really weird. Who in this monastery got a black towel? I was fully awake, it was in the middle of the day, and I just stared at it for about 2 or 3 minutes, a long time. And then it turned to its usual colour, white again. And it was weird. And I wasn't imagining it, you know, you don't go on drugs as monks. But it was really weird. And now I understand what's going on there, that when you see something, what is actually a white colour? White is just a perception. You take some information and the mind decides that that's white. Just because you're conditioned, your perception is in this narrow framework and it's prohibited from doing weird things. In other words, seeing a white towel as black. But when you start to meditate, you actually free your perception. They can do really weird things. They can see things which shouldn't happen. Now, once you understand what's going on there, you're not going crazy or mad, but it's good fun. Because, you know, saying it's boring life being a monk. When you see walls disappear, oh, that's really neat. It's, you know, you can't watch movies and you can't sort of watch these video games. You can play with the mind. And that's really great fun. But you're in control of this in the sense that, you know, it's not sort of you're going crazy. You can stop it very easily by just saying stop. Because the perception sort of is subject to suggestion. And so I understood this very quickly. I've got a sharp mind. And so once, when I was meditating, if this ever happens to you, this is the solution. Once I was meditating, and I saw this image of this demon. It was a nimitta, but a really ugly, frightening one. It was like a devil, right in front of me. They always put their tongues out, the big bulging eyes. Had this necklace of skulls, and it's actually teeth with fangs, and it's like dripping all like blood. They were really scary. But straight away I recognised that. There was a picture from the temple wall. You can now have these like big sort of demon pictures, which you can sometimes see. I recognised what that was, where it was from. And so I knew this was like a creation of the mind. My perception was just, you know, having fun. So I made some suggestions. Literally, just a suggestion was all it needed was to black out a few teeth. It's called like doodling. And actually, if any of you go to our monastery and look at the telephone books or other sort of little magazines, because sometimes on the telephone books they got like pictures of pretty girls. Because they always have models on the front of anything, telephone books, whatever. And so because there's some young monks in our monastery, I allow them to actually to doodle and they black out the teeth. And they put sort of sunglasses on and sort of cigarettes coming out and other stuff which they put. It's only like being childish, but you know, it's good fun as a monk. You can be childish, you don't have to be grown up. And anyhow, so I started doing this with my demon. Blacked out its teeth, put a fag on the end of its mouth, and sunglasses, Ray-Bans on its eyes, and a big straw hat with a flower coming out. And that's what happened. My demon, who was a minute ago, was absolutely terrifying. It became so ridiculous. I laughed and never came back again. I completely humiliated it. That's a great way of getting rid of ghosts. Humiliate them. They never come back to you again. And I just taught that about a couple of months ago, because there was a guy in our monastery on a little retreat, and he was actually looking at the paving bricks, and he saw these demons come out of the paving bricks. And obviously he got a bit scared. And I just told him this technique. He said, when you see those demons come out, black out their fangs. Put some sunnies on them. And he did that. He thanked me so much. He said, it was so easy to do, because once you have the idea, the suggestion, it just works straight away. And he said, it was such good fun, sort of, you know, doodling with these, you know, demons, and they weren't terrifying anymore. And, you know, after a day or so, they completely disappeared. So he never went crazy, but he learned about the mind and what it can do. So if you ever see some weird and strange things like that, most teachers say don't play around with that, but I say no, play around with it. You can learn quite a lot. You have some fun as well. No, there's nothing much going on in a retreat. You can't watch the TV, but you've got one inside if you know how to make use of it. You can have some weird fun in there, weird fun and games. But you know that it's not real, it's just playing. And it's the mind is beginning to be able to create things. You know, perception is going to be free, you can do whatever you want. And actually, what it shows you is just how limited we are with the way we look at things. We are completely conditioned and trained to look at things in one way, to see a wall as solid. And actually, you can see it just vanishing. And if that happens, don't think you're going crazy. It's just your meditation is starting to go well, and you're starting to be able to see things in completely ridiculous, illogical ways. It's great fun. You understand what perception is and how it's just one way of looking at things. So, is there any questions about that? Da da da. Okay. Next question. Please tell us. Oh, that's what I did there. Limitless. Next one. The incessant hunger seems to have disappeared. You see, it wasn't incessant. Give it enough time, you either get over your hunger or you starve to death. But one way or the other, the hunger disappears. And it's great, actually, because when you don't see food in the evening, and you don't smell it, and it's just not there, you forget about it. And after a while, the stomach gets used to just eating in the morning time. And there's no problem there at all. Eating less now, but not feeling any less strong. Is it a positive spin-off of meditation? Yeah. Because also, remember, when you're meditating, you're not doing very much. And physically, you're not sort of running around, because you do a lot, waste a lot of energy running backwards and forwards to the car, no, because you're very, very busy, you have to do things very quickly, and also you spend a huge amount of energy thinking. And I read this in a medical journal. I think your brain uses most of your energy, even more than your legs and your arm. Your brain consumes a huge proportion. I think it might be something like 80% of all the food which you actually consume. The energy goes into your brain. Now, of course, you know, you can ask the monks, I don't actually eat that much, but I put on a lot of weight, because my brain doesn't use so much, because I don't think so much like ordinary people. So, you know, this is why I got all these excuses for being overweight. So, whatever. So, be careful. If you meditate, you usually put on weight, and that's why they got the fat Buddha, because he's a great meditator. But the point being, your brain does use up a lot of energy. And so when you're sort of being still and being peaceful, you don't need so much food. When your car, your vehicle is idling, it does not consume so much gas. So don't need to fill it up so often. That's great. Would people like to have the evening chanting recorded for the CD, say Friday or Saturday? We've already got the evening chanting on CD. So it's already been done. I think the nuns did the evening chanting. So usually, like, unfortunately, that because of the tradition, like the older monks, usually they have to be the one who leads the chanting. And you all know that sort of the older you get, the worse your chanting voice is. And actually, my chanting, I used to be quite good at chanting. I used to chant in public. I chanted in public. In the football stadiums of London. Chanting at soccer matches with the other hooligans. But anyhow, no. So my chanting was pretty good. I actually sang in a choir when I was a kid. In the church choir. I did it just for money, because they used to pay you. I wasn't a Christian, but if they paid me, I'd do anything. It doesn't matter about the religion. I was a poor boy, come from a poor family. So it's already there, and I think the nuns of the chanting is very, very beautiful. So if you want that chanting, it's already there. Available from the Buddhist Society of Western Australia at a very reasonable price. Ajahn, please tell us how we can kill the knower. Thank you. That's a bit rough, isn't it? Kill the knower. You murderer. You don't kill it, it just disappears. So again, you don't kill anything in this Buddhism. So you just allow it to disappear. So it's letting go and things just vanish and vanish and vanish. There was in Greek mythology this, I think it's in the Homer's Odyssey, this demon called the Hydra. And this Hydra, it had these many heads. And as soon as you cut off one of its heads, it grew another two. And so that was a very difficult beast to actually destroy. And it's the same what we do with defilements. If we kill them, okay, we get rid of that defilement, we get two more in its place. And that's what it's like when we control and we try to annihilate the source of our problems. We get two more problems where we only had one. So that negativity and killing never works. It's like trying to kill a hydra. So instead of that, we have to I don't know exactly how Homer actually managed to, or Odyssey, whichever you call him, Odysseus, how he ever killed that hydra.
With fire.
Fire?
Yeah, and he burned the stump, tree, cut the heads off. And I think it was Hercules.
It was Hercules. Ah, well, they're all the same, these Greeks. But anyhow, he sort of had to use some wisdom, some smart things, actually, so the hydra wouldn't grow any more heads. So that's just sometimes what we have to do. You use wisdom to let go of the knower, not force. Killing things never works. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that the knowledge of deliverance of anatta may sometimes take weeks to unravel after the experience of jhana. Now, it is my understanding that one needs to have a mind that has clear comprehension and understanding, free from all defilements, to be able to see non-self. Therefore, after weeks of attaining a jhana, some or all the defilements may be active again in one's mind, and the window of opportunity to uncover non-self may be lost. Please clarify. Thank you. If after a jhana, sometimes especially the five hindrances, sometimes have gone for a long time. That's why sometimes after a jhana, people think they're enlightened. They've got no hindrances anymore. Just no one can make them angry. You know, you're not interested in your food. You sit through lunch. You've got no desire, no sexual lust, no ill will or anger. You see the mosquito and say, "Oh, mosquito, you must be very hungry. Come and bite me. Come on. For free, come on." And you feel so sort of spiritual and holy. And because the five hindrances are so suppressed, they've been KO'd, knocked out. But later on they come back again, and you realize, oh my goodness, I wasn't enlightened after all. But after the jhana, they disappear for a long time. It's because it's a long time, that's why sometimes those great insights can come, sometimes days later. Sometimes what happens, you've knocked the hindrances out, they get up again, but they fall down again. So sometimes they vanish very quickly a few days afterwards. So sometimes it does happen days afterwards. So it doesn't have to be straight afterwards. Someone like the Buddha, you know, straight after his jhana, he got the enlightenment experiences, as recorded in the suttas. Other people, it took longer. Like Ananda, much longer. Any questions on that? Da-da-da. So there is still hope for you yet. Not much, but there's some. That is heaps. Some instructors speak of short and long breath, beginning, middle and end of breath is to be watched. Can you please explain this? When you are watching the breath, sometimes it's good to give it something of interest, just so you can grab onto it a bit easier. But just say in and out, it's a bit boring. So you can actually start to describe it more, you know, like, is it a long one or a short one? So it's you can make all sorts of little games to make the breath more interesting. Say, is the in-breath longer than the out-breath, or is it shorter than the out-breath? The gap between the in-breath and the out-breath, and the gap between the out-breath and the in-breath, which is longer or shorter?
Well, but then you start thinking
again. You're thinking, yes, but you are focusing the thought on the breath. So you're limiting thinking, but it's just on this one object. Which is why you can also have a little commentary about the breath at this stage. You're not thinking about your family, you're not thinking about the food, you're not thinking about money, you're just thinking just about the breath. So it's limiting the thought to a small area. It's better not to have any thought at all, but if you can't do that, have thought about the meditation object. So you can actually start saying, this breath, it's carrying oxygen from all the flowers and the trees, all that's green outside. That's where your oxygen gets replenished from nature. And the carbon dioxide which comes out from your lungs is your gift to those same trees and flowers outside, because that's what they need. So in your breath, you're connecting with nature. And sometimes when you make a little commentary like that, it makes the breath, oh, really interesting. You're becoming one with all that's green outside in the world. And you're in harmony with it. The oxygen comes from the flowers and the plants, and your carbon dioxide goes back for them. Isn't this wonderful? So this way you're kenning a little commentary with the breath, which makes it easy to watch the breath. Sometimes that people do a mantra with the breath. The most common one, breathing in Bud, breathing out To, Bud Ho, Bud Ho. Again, you're doing something, but it makes it easier just to get hold of the breath at the beginning. Once the breath is in mind, you can let go of all that commentary and all that description, all those thinking. But to start with, you can do that. You can do long or short, it's just one example. So you can make this nice little description of the breath. And that helps at the beginning. So that's what the Buddha meant by long or short. And that's why other teachers say, watch the beginning, middle and end. Makes it a little bit more interesting at the beginning. Other people actually count the breath. So you told me today that you did maths at university, so this is very good for you. You can actually count the breath. Breathing in one, breathing out one. Breathing in two, out two. In three, out three. In four. In five, out five. In six, out six. In seven, out seven. In eight, out eight. In nine, out nine. Without your calculator, you can't bring that in. And then you start up again. In one, out one. In two, out two. In three, out three. In four. In five, out five. In six, out six. In seven, out seven. In eight, out eight. This time only up to eight. Next one, in one, out one, in two, out two, three, three, four, five, five, six, six, in seven, out seven. It's just a seven. Then from one to six, one to five, then one to four, then in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three. In one, out one, in two, out two, and last of all, in one, out one. You've watched 45 breaths in a row. That just gets you focused on the breath, and it gives it something interesting to do. And also, it's a good check to see whether you're really mindful or not. Because sometimes in the early morning when I used to do this, I found myself saying, in 17, out 17, you know. I completely lost my mindfulness. So I had to start at the beginning again. So that, yeah.
Buddha never said anything on those special ones. Like in Girimanda Sutta, he talks only about short and long, but the amount of description about it,
doesn't he? Yeah, but this is just... Well, the Buddha said about the short and long, it was just an example of the sort of things you can do with a breath to make it a little bit interesting. Because when you first watch it, you need a bit more of a handle on it to be able to keep it in your mind for long enough. If you can just watch in-breath, out-breath, that's the best. But if you can, if you need something else, some description there to make it interesting, then you can count it, you can say it's a long breath or a medium breath. But the point is you should never control the breath and make it long or make it short. You just notice whichever one it is. Okay, the next one. Could you please explain the term stream winner, once returner, non-returner? And should be an arahat instead of stream enterer. What are the Pali equivalents? This will be revealed in a day or two's time when I talk about enlightenment. So, stay tuned. The answer is coming soon. The Ajahn, using the framework of stream enterer, here we go again. Stream enterer, once returner, how should we view the rebirth of successive Dalai Lamas? If he keeps on being reborn, he can't be enlightened. Because an enlightened being would never be reborn. Actually, he asked the Dalai Lama, he says he's just an ordinary monk. He's a very nice monk. But, is he enlightened or is he not enlightened? How can you tell? The answer is coming in a couple of days' time, so stay tuned to the talk on enlightenment. Is that okay? Because there's a lot of questions here, so the ones I'm going to give a talk on, I'll actually go into more depth later on. Is that okay? Does anyone want to ask any questions on that, or can we leave it till a couple of days' time? Very good. Next question. Dear Ajahn, no questions, just my love and my gratitude. Thank you. Ah, isn't that nice? That's the best question. Thank you for sucking up to me. it's good to suck up to your teacher. The seven factors of enlightenment, Satipajanga, are they achieved when the Eightfold Path is followed? Absolutely. So it's another way of talking about the Eightfold Path. So, I'm going to test you all now. Whoever wrote that, asked that question, what's the first of the seven factors of enlightenment? What is it? Begins with an M. Mindfulness. Yes, you're very clever. That's the first one, mindfulness. And it's interesting, these seven factors of enlightenment, that you can see how they go one after the other. It's followed by Dhammavicaya, which is investigating the Dhammas. You need mindfulness, first of all, to investigate, to go in. And you need virya. I was arguing with Ajahn Brahmari, not really arguing, but I was suggesting in a talk I gave there that the word in Pali, virya, it's has the same root as another similar Pali word, vira, which is like a hero. And most people know that as the one of the names for the leader of the Jains called Mahavira, means like the great hero, because they said he was enlightened. So it's not just striving, it's like heroic effort. Like a hero willing to give up your life for, your country or whatever. That's what a hero is. So this virya is something which you're willing to abandon everything. It's heroic effort. The next one is we get into the interesting stuff now. So you've got this, the investigating the Dhammas, getting a bit of insight as you go along with mindfulness and insight and this little energy, heroic energy, willing to sort of sacrifice everything for truth. And then you get pity, the start of joy. Now that here even is an important part of the whole process. Mindfulness leading to joy. And only after joy you get tranquility. This pasadi. And this actually is repeated in many other causal sequences in the suttas. Now from the joy, only then do you get tranquility. Tranquility of body and tranquility of mind. If you are in pain, then you can never be still. There's always something bothering you. You always have to scratch. You always have to move. But when you have joy, you find you don't need to move at all. To prove that, you watch somebody watching the cricket. And they can watch it there even though they need to go to the toilet. Even they're busting to go. Even though they've got so much aches and pains in their knees. Still, they've got to watch this last over. Because of that, it shows you that when you're enjoying it, you do become still. And it's not just bodily still, it's mental stillness. So all comes from joy. So this is why you have to see that nimitta and get some joy up. Otherwise the meditation doesn't go. Viriyam piti pasati. And after the stillness, or after pasadi, samadhi, the jhanas. And after the jhanas, it's equanimity. You've let go. Those are the seven enlightenment factors. Very similar to the Eightfold Path. Okay. That's in brief though. Okay. Next question. What era did Amitabha Buddha arise from? Are there still followers of Amitabha Buddha still in Japan? I think I have heard of this sect. The first time we hear of Amitabha was about 2nd or 3rd century of the Common Era. So the first sutta of Amitabha came a long time after the suttas were written. And it's a bit sus. Because the idea is that as long as you recite the name of Amitabha, then you'll get reborn into Amitabha's realm. Because actually, an Amitabha's realm is called the pure land. And there, if you want to hear any music, just have to think about it. Jimi Hendrix, and you hear Voodoo Child. If you want to hear, I remember that, but what else is other music? You've got any movie you want to see. If you want to see Harry Potter, straight away, just thinking about it, and it's there in front of you. Any food you want to eat. If you sort of want to eat sort of fish and chips, you just think about it, and then straight away, even in a newspaper, it just appears right in front of you. So this is a pure land. And to me, that was just like sensuous. And I said, you can't sort of think this is next to enlightenment. But what it was very, very attractive, number one, was because you don't have to do very much. You don't have to keep precepts or meditate or do this hard work sitting here and not eating in the evening. All you do is chant Amitofu, and you go to this pure land, you get everything you want, have a really nice time, and afterwards you become enlightened. So, you know, it's actually really well packaged. And it was actually seeing what people want and giving it to them. And people still buy into it. So basically, you know, it doesn't work. I've got to be honest about it. But, you know, many people believe it. But at least that a lot of people actually, that at least they try and just not just do the chanting now, but actually to try and be good people as well. Which is marvellous, actually. They've taken the Pure Land much further. And what I'm really fascinated about is that the name Amitabha, Abha is radiance, Amitabha means unmeasurable radiance. And that's nimittas and jhanas. So if you want to meet Amitabha, right here in this retreat, you get into those beautiful nimittas of unlimited radiance. And that's what Amitabha means. So then actually you can become one with Amitabha. And that's pretty pure. And there's still people follow Amitabha because it's very easy.
In the Sutra, it says that you have to recite the name
without any thoughts and defilements before you go into the sutra. But that sutra was not written by the Buddha, it was composed a long time afterwards. So some of it, the teachers sometimes say, just need to chant the name and that's enough, even if you have defilements, out of the great compassion of Amitabha. But it's what you say is true now, that many teachers are now saying it's obviously not enough. You need to do more than that. So that becomes like almost like a meditation technique. If you do that as a meditation technique, and you chant Amitabha as like a mantra till you get very, very still, who knows, that may be actually be able to generate a nimitta. And if it does generate a nimitta that way, and it takes you into the jhanas, then fine, you're away. Next, from what you said, I understand that a person can attain nirvana. Will he or she then give up all day-to-day responsibilities and lead a monastic lifestyle with metta? Now this is an interesting one. If you became enlightened in this retreat, what will happen to you? You will find out in a couple of days when I talk about it. Because you did give up a lot. And the funny story was, I won't say who this is, but some of you know this person very well. They were on this retreat in Sri Lanka many years ago. and with this one of the teachers over there. And you know, the teacher was actually telling you, you know, oh, you've done really well, now you're a stream winner. And he would actually tell you what you, where you got to. It wasn't right, it was false, but it was very believable. And so this man sort of was over there doing a retreat, and he would now call his wife every few days, and he told his wife, my teacher just told me I just got stream winner today. And obviously his wife was just really pleased and happy. Oh, great, marvellous, well done. And then a few days later, he rang again and said, my teacher said I'm a once returner now. That's amazing, that's wonderful. Oh, I'm so happy for you. And then he rang a few days later, he said, I'm now a non-returner. And I got her worried. And she said, you better come home quick, pay off the mortgage before you become an outlaw. That's what she said. It's very funny. Anyway, we'll talk about that in more depth. More depth. We'll do the enlightenment talk, probably on Saturday morning. Ajahn, is it a good idea to have a Buddhist statue, flowers, candles, etc. if I want to meditate at home? Should the meditation start with Namo Tassa, Itibiso, thank you? You don't have to do that chanting. You can if you want. You don't have to have a statue. You can if you want. You can have candles or not candles. That's not so important. If it helps, fine. If it's too much of a pain, then not necessary. Especially if you're living with another person who's not a Buddhist, and sometimes they get a bit upset. If you've got all this religious paraphernalia, you know, in your room, then, you know, and they're not. I remember reading this very nice little book about this witch. What was her name? But anyway, it's an English witch who became quite famous because after they revealed, they repealed the witch laws, she actually went out and said that she was a witch, she'd been practicing for a long time, her wife was, mother was a witch. And because she went around saying that she was, you know, a really dinky-dy witch, she got invited to all these places to give talks. And she said once she was invited over to the United States to give some talks about witchcraft. And in those days there was no aircraft, they went on a boat. And she had to share a cabin. And she didn't mind sharing a cabin. She was a really nice girl. But the person she was sharing a cabin with turned out to be an evangelical Christian, which was okay. But the Christian kept on doing her, what's the chant they call? The prayers and the... one of those things where you do the hymns. Singing the hymns with proper voice early in the morning. And so this other lady, Sybil Leek, I think her name was. That's right, Sybil Leek. And so Sybil told her, look, I've got to share the cabin with you. You know, we've got to have a bit of give and take. You know, just can you calm it down a bit? Because, you know, I want to be peaceful. This evangelical Christian said, no, it's my right and it's good to actually to praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Hallelujah. And so Sybil decided, well, the only way I can get some peace and quiet is to teach her a lesson. So she got all her witch paraphernalia out and started doing a witchcraft service. And and this evangelist, she said, I gave her a chance, but she wouldn't listen to reason. So she got all her daggers out and stuff. And this evangelical, she ran out of the room, and Sybil had the cabin to herself for the rest of the voyage. So she's very a funny lady. And she wrote, they're really down to earth. And they're really a good person, nothing evil about her, but just she was having a bit of fun and games. So be careful about having too much paraphernalia in your house. Otherwise, people might get a bit upset. I know that when Ajahn, people say when Ajahn Chattamala did a retreat here last time, he brought his skull from his monastery. You got this old skull. Now, skulls are really great to have in your house. If you can put them, especially in front of the door, it's much better than a burglar alarm. Any burglar goes in there. They'll do something terrible to their pants and run out again. It's good to have a skull as a burglar proof. Anyway, Ajahn, you mentioned to keep still when the breath disappears, the nimitta should emerge. What if it does not emerge for some time? Then there is the tendency for the mind to become restless. What next? Thank you for your guidance. be patient. If it doesn't come, what are you aware of now? What's in the mind? So whatever it is, stay with that. It's peaceful because the breath has disappeared. Stay with that. Don't do anything and wait. Remember the simile of the still forest pool. Ajahn Chah had to sit there and wait for the animals to come out. They're going to come out. But you've got to be patient and wait. And then it comes. So just wait. Be more patient. In meditation, we put a stop to everything. Be with the present moment. How do we apply it to daily life, during work, where we have to plan, think, strategies, be on the move all the time? You don't have to be on the move all the time. Otherwise, you get stressed out. You know, you've all heard this old simile before. It's like Ajahn Chah said, how heavy is a cup of water? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. If you keep holding it for half an hour, I'll be in great pain. If I keep holding this for 2 hours like this, I'm a very stupid monk. What should I do when it starts to get heavy? Put it down, yeah. Do I have to throw it away? No, just put it down for a few seconds, maybe 30 seconds. And you pick it up again afterwards and it feels light. If you don't believe me, try it for yourself. Hold it for 2 hours. And how stupid you feel. But just hold it for about 5 minutes until it starts to get heavy. Put it down and pick it up again. It feels lighter. When you know how to stop and let go from time to time, you can find that you can lessen the stress of your life and you can carry things with more ease. It's actually basic efficiency in your work schedule. When things get tight and tense, take time out. Apparently in big corporations, they do have a timeout room for the executives. They get stressed out, they go in there, and mobile phones, they've got some gizmo there that you can't reach get any signal from your mobile or from your laptop. It's timeout rooms, because they realize if you have to make a decision, you've got to be clear. You've got to be sharp. And if you're just really burnt out, tired, you're not going to make good decisions. So in real life, if you know how to stop and let go from time to time, don't mean just stopping forever, but pausing, resting. And then when you pick up your burden again, it's so much lighter, you become a very efficient person in business. That's why in April, many of you know, I've been invited to give a keynote address at the London 2007 Human Resources and Development Conference, in front of 2,000 CEOs and business leaders. I'm a Buddhist monk. So simply teaching the CEOs how to run their business. Just teaching things like this. Learn how to just put your glass down from time to time. It works. So, I know all about how to run businesses. Well, at least people think I do. We get invited to give all these big speeches at conferences. That's how you do it with daily life. Next. Any comments about that? Okay, next question coming up. You mentioned that of the time of the death, we stay with the nimitta and that determines our next birth. Sort of, yeah. Isn't your rebirth also in some way determined by our past karma? There's two things which determine your future birth. One is your karmic wherewithal and also your desire. In the same way, if you want to go overseas, say you want to go to London, just because you want to go to London, you're not going to get there. You need a ticket, first of all. If you have a ticket but you don't want to go, you still won't get there. If you want to get to London, you need both a ticket and the will to go there. The ticket is like the karmic resource. And it's also the will, that's where you want to go. Because sometimes people have got lots and lots of good karma, but they told me that in the next birth, they want to be reborn as a dog. They do. I said, what do you want to be reborn as a dog for? They said, oh, a dog doesn't have to go to work on a Monday morning. They can lie around all day. They can be fed. They get petted. Have a lovely life. They've got no worries. Isn't that great, being a dog? No worries at all. There's no thing to worry about your finances, about credit cards. You know, you just bark, woof, 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 and you get food. But then I told them, actually, you know, most dogs, they have to go to a vet for an operation. And when I tell them that, they said, I don't want to be a dog anymore, I don't want to be a dog anymore, I don't want to be a dog anymore. But the thing is, even if you may have the karmic resources to get reborn in the high deva realm, heaven realm, sometimes people don't want that. They just want to be reborn as a cat or a dog, and that's what happens to them, yes. Yes, where you want to, where you tend to. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you have to have the karmic resources to get there. And it's where you're inclining towards, where you want to get reborn. So sometimes, very often, because you've been a human being before, you want to be a human being again. That's where you think you belong. If you've been a human being before, many people get reborn as a human being. Because that's where they think they belong. Especially if their life is interrupted as they die young. And you just get drawn back to the human realm, because that's where you think you belong. You don't have much affinity, you know, with other animals.
So if you die young, then
you get reborn pretty quickly as a human being, yeah. Sometimes, yes, happens, yep. Because that's your attachments. Maybe, you know, that, say if you die young, you're very attached to your husband, say. You may actually get reborn as, you know, in the same family as maybe your sister's son or something. In order to be close to that same family again. So it happens very regularly. But it's best not to get reborn at all in this human realm. Because if you get reborn in this human realm, you will have to wear nappies again. And you'll have to go back to school and think you've finished with all that school business. And you have to probably get married again. Oh my goodness. Yes? Yeah?
Can you actually go back to being an animal?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If you behave like an animal, you get reborn as one. I told the monks the other day in the monastery, if you spend too long sleeping, because like the animals, they're actually in part, they're called the horizontal beings, it's called Tirachana Gata. Tirachana means like going horizontal. No, and Gata means going. So that you can understand that. Like, animals always go horizontal, only human beings go vertical. So if you spend too much time in bed, you actually get reborn as a horizontal being. Yes. Ah, it is. Yeah, the Buddha actually says that, but we're fortunate there's so many, such a huge population, there's actually so many vacancies. So that's why people would normally not get reborn as a human being, get reborn as a human being. Many of the animals, because these animal vacancies have really gone down, because there's many habitats and many animal populations have decreased enormously. So many of them have got reborn as humans.
And I heard that it's important to be reborn as humans, because that's the only way you can reach
life. Yes, it's not the only way, but it's the best way. So it's great to be reborn as a human being. But people get reborn as a human being and they don't worry about enlightenment. They just want to watch the cricket and have sex and watch movies. So they're wasting their time. It really depends exactly what they do afterwards. If they know about forgiveness, they can forgive themselves and let it go, they made a big mistake, don't do it again, then sure they can get reborn. Because in a sense it's your inclinations, what you have in your mind afterwards, and your karma. And you've got a huge store of good karma and a huge store of bad karma. And which one are you going to sort of use and break out? So it's really up to you. You wouldn't believe just how much choice you can have about your rebirth.
What about
euthanasia? Euthanasia? It's sometimes that you see some cases of euthanasia that's, if it is bad karma, it's such small bad karma, it's almost irrelevant. Remember, there's not just black karma and white karma, good and bad. There's these things in the middle, like abortion and euthanasia. And you can't really say it's even good or bad karma, because sometimes a girl has been raped, or the baby is deformed, or the case which I often quote, because I was in London visiting my mother, I was watching the news on her TV, and there was a case in Cardiff or Swansea. A woman was pregnant with two kids in her womb, two fetuses, and I don't know what this condition was. The doctors were absolutely certain, 100%, if they didn't do anything, that the mother and the two kids would die. If they aborted one of the children in the womb, the mother and the other kid would survive. So it's a moral dilemma. If you left it alone, did nothing, then everyone would die. If you killed one of the fetuses, the mother and the other fetus would live. And it was, this debate was going on the TV. The Christians were saying, no, it's God's will. Let God do something. What would the Buddhists say? And as a Buddhist, I would say, well, you've got a choice there between, non-doing is a doing in this particular case. The doctor has a responsibility, a duty of care. If it does nothing, you're killing three. So in that case, if I was a doctor, I would have also intervened and aborted one of the fetuses so the other two would survive. That was, I would say, the ethically moral superior choice. But before the argument was really debated in full, they found out the doctor had just done that. He just aborted one fetus so the other fetus and the mother could live. It's a great real situation, which happened. But the choice was actually between killing three and killing one.
Ashram, what about stillbirths or if your children who perhaps have that language will they next birth?
Oh yeah, there's a classic case of that over here. I often tell this story for people who have stillbirths or have abortions. Here in Perth there is a family, I won't say who they are, but the first time that the woman got pregnant, it's very, very, comes to our temple really often. Had an ultrasound about 3 or 4 days before the birth, but during the time between the last ultrasound and the birth, the little kid had twisted itself around on the umbilical cord and was stillborn, had strangled itself. And of course, the mother was quite upset, but because she was a good Buddhist, she took it very easily. And because I knew that I did the funeral service for them. And I remember just the funeral service, they actually dressed the baby boy, it was a boy, just out of the womb, it was fully formed, a complete full term of the pregnancy. And they actually put it in a tiny little coffin, as they do in the funeral parlours, and they actually tilted it up, so it was vertical, and had me and all the family around, so they could take a family photo. So the boy actually made it into the family photo just. And then they put the coffin down, we did the ceremony, and then took to the crematorium to be burnt. What they didn't tell me, and it's actually quite common in Thailand and also other countries, while I wasn't looking, while the funeral director wasn't looking, they got an ordinary biro pen and drew a line on the baby's heel. The idea is that if it's going to come back again, because you're still a healthy young woman, and they still want your kids, they might have a birthmark in the same place. And you have to draw this line at a place where you don't usually get birthmarks, and you don't get birthmarks on heels. But when the next child was born as a successful pregnancy, it was a girl with that birthmark on its foot. They got a line exactly where they drew it. And they're all very, very convinced that that was their previous boy who didn't quite make it the last time, had another shot, and this time got through. It was a girl this time, yeah. But I got to admit, that was a very tomboy of a girl. Yeah, just because, when I heard the story, I obviously looked at her, and she just behaved like a boy. I think she's changed now, she's become more girlish, but when she was really young, wow, she was very, very boyish. Would hang out with the boys rather than with the girls. Yeah, it's very common, yeah. Yeah. It's very common, those things. Because actually there's a whole book by Ian Stevenson about people who put marks on your body to see if that person's going to come back again. We have to do it in a place where you don't usually get a birthmark, just to be absolutely sure.
That means that you get carried the body again to make
it? Well, it's carried some of it. It's really strange exactly how it works, why there's a line there, because it's a completely different fetus. But somehow or other it carries that imprint, and it has had that birthmark on there. Just like people who especially people who are killed, like they're shot. And there's one case I remember in Ian Stevenson's book. He did actually this research on birthmarks while he was a visiting fellow at Magdalen College in Oxford. I always quote that because, you know, even though the Oxford is quite lower than Cambridge. No, but obviously Oxford is a really good university. So, you know, they invited this fellow as a visiting fellow, so that gave him a lot of credibility, a lot of kudos. But while he was doing that there in Magdalen, he was doing this research on birthmarks. And one of the people who remembered a previous life had a birthmark on the front of his head, which the family noticed, and they checked his past life, yet he'd been shot there. But what Ian Stevenson was a medical doctor before he became a psychiatrist. And he knew that when you have, like, get shot in the head, you have an exit wound as well. And the exit wound is always bigger than the entry wound, because when a bullet goes through, it carries all of the stuff from the brain and bits of old bone. And as it comes out, it makes a bigger hole in the back of the head. So they wanted to find out if he had an exit wound. And so they did not know. They had to shave his hair, and they actually found a big birthmark on the back as well. So little things like that, which is very, very convincing. Even the family didn't know there was a birthmark on the back because he had too much hair. Could only see it when you actually shave the hair off. So fascinating things about rebirth, and that's what happens. Okay. Next question coming up. Please explain again the doer and the knower, the controlling mind, etc. The doer is what reacts. The doer is what thinks. The doer is what complains. The doer is that which wants to go to bed. And the knower. The knower is what can listen, can hear. It's the receptive part of the mind. The doer is the reactive part of the mind. Hope that's quite clear. What happens to brain activity during jhana? If this is not known, would you be willing to be subject in tests to find out? Fortunately, it is known. Because otherwise, you know, people put all these electrodes on you, and I'm busy enough as it is without having all this gizmos. It has been known. Because you all know that one of the people here in Perth, and some of you know who he is, but some of you don't. So I better not tell his name, because he was meditating at home. And as he was meditating at home, he'd only meditate for about 40 minutes. But he was told his wife, "I'll meditate in my bedroom." After an hour and a half, he hadn't come out. I may get some of the details wrong, because it's a long time since I heard the story, but it's roughly right. I checked the main details with him. After an hour and a half, he hadn't come out of his room. So his wife went into his bedroom to check him out. Is he okay? And she saw her husband sitting really still in meditation. Very still. Too still! She couldn't see him breathing. She looked, the chest wasn't coming up and down at all. So what would you do? 000, she rang. She called the ambulance. This was an emergency. And so the ambulance came with its sirens wailing. And as soon as they came into the bedroom, they checked his pulse. Couldn't find any pulse. Now these are medics. If I checked the pulse, I'd probably look in the wrong place. But these were medics. They couldn't find no pulse at all. This was emergency. So they put him in the stretcher, rushed him into the ambulance, and with the sirens wailing, going through every red light, which was red, because seconds mattered. And they rushed him to Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital, one of the great teaching hospitals here in Perth. And they rushed him into the room. And as soon as they rushed him into the room, they put on the ECG to see if there's any heartbeat. And as soon as they connected him up, the monitor was flat. Beep. I usually go ding, 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 emergency, but I was told the other day it doesn't do that. It goes beep, flat line, cardiac arrest. And they put on the EEG to see if there's any brain activity. As soon as they put the gizmo on, the monitor, beep, another flat line, he was brain dead. Brain dead, cardiac arrest. With all the gizmos showing that this was a fact. Now it was very lucky that the doctor on duty that afternoon or morning, whatever it was of Indian extraction. His parents had migrated to Perth. He grew up in Perth and did his degree. He'd already heard from his parents that sometimes that yogis in deep meditation can suspend their life activities. If he hadn't been Indian, if he'd been an Australian, that man had been sent straight down to the morgue. And when he came out of his meditation, which he later did, he would have probably killed every morgue attendant who saw him get up. It must be very frightening working down there. But because he was an Indian, he decided to give this guy a chance. Because he heard from his wife, he'd been meditating. Maybe he was suspending his life activity, so he put the defibrillators on his chest. Bang! Because actually they make a noise, and actually you rise up above, now 1 or 2 millimeters above the bed, you know, to try and stimulate your heart. Time and time again they use electric shocks, but nothing works. Every time, beep, said the ECG. Beep, replied the ECG. You're saying it. But eventually he decided to come out of his meditation. When he came out of his meditation, he opened his eyes. Beep, beep. Beep, ordinary heartbeat. Beep, 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 ordinary brain activity. Perfectly okay. Doctor checked him up, nothing wrong with him, so he walked home. No, he wasn't. He just fluked it. So he's never been able to do that again. No clues.
With what's done on meditation, that person was on the time of where exactly they checked the heartbeat,
the
EEG for a couple of hours, and I think full day or something. And they did find that a lot of changes, like very slow wave patterns, slow heart rate,
yeah.
And temperature has gone down, and you know. But I suppose they don't know if they're in jhana and things, but using meditation, proper meditation,
Yeah. That's right. I think the latest thing from Harvard was.
It's a pity that there are no sort of statistics done or any journals or something
we
can write with things.
No, there's one professor actually in Harvard who specializes in meditation and its effect on the brain. And her latest research shows actually the cortex actually grows thicker. So you actually get more brain power by meditating. You've got more brain, literally, because people have done meditations. So it's not if you don't use it, you lose it. If you use it, it grows. So.
I can see it done, I mean, certain months in Sri Lanka, other places, they use it all years to meditate.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. As long as you meditate. And it's also as long as you're happy. Because the other research was when you're happy, your arteries dilate. Which means that one thing which I've always noticed, the only fat people who you know about are fat and happy. You ever notice that? You always have fat and jolly people. And the reason is, I figured out that if you're fat and miserable, then the happiness actually dilates the arteries and it compensates for the extra cholesterol you're carrying because you're fat. So if you're fat and miserable, you die young. That's why there's never any fat and miserable people left. But if you're fat and happy, the happiness and the laughter actually expands your arteries and it compensates for all the extra cholesterol. So the fat and happy people, they live. So the only people who see a fat are always happy. That's actually how we get the idea of like the jolly fat people. Go on, yes. I don't know if you'd agree with me as a doctor. Go on. Ananda?
The Maharishi yogi, he teaches transcendental meditation.
Yeah.
If you use that method, can you go into jhanas?
I don't know. I don't know too much about it. They use a mantra, but I don't know how deeply they go. It's interesting. Place thing I don't know, because they're usually very secretive.
No, I think if each person gets one mantra,
yeah.
It's unique to that person.
That's what they say, because you're not allowed to tell anybody else.
No, you don't tell anybody.
That's right, you don't know if it's unique. It could all be the exactly the same mantra.
You meditate on that mantra.
Yeah.
Of course, you get comfy, you know.
Yeah.
And with this also.
Oh, yeah. That's right, all meditation works. Yeah, all meditation gives you a low blood pressure, but it's the jhanas where you start doing the weird stuff, such as that guy who stopped his heartbeat and stopped his brain activity. He was perfectly okay, he was just blissed out. And he never actually heard the sirens, nor did he feel the electric shocks. But he was perfectly aware, but inside. Very interesting, very weird. Ajahn, I'm only able to do walking meditation. Fine. While doing so, I can focus on the alternative left-right footing. Apart from that, I don't feel any other sensation. I hear things, people walking, birds. Am I progressing? Of course you are. You're going forward. So good. Enjoy it. If you're unable to do that, that's wonderful. Fine. So you're one of the great meditators who's not proud, who's not trying to get into jhanas. So you're one of the people who might get into jhanas because you're not trying so hard. Ajahn, when one dies after attaining only first stage of jhana, should he, she start all over again? Well, if you've got the first stage of jhana, then you're going to be a very, very sort of spiritual person. And you keep those inclinations. So if you get reborn again, there's an inclination to be a very, very peaceful, still person. I forget who it was. There was one girl told me, I forget who she was, I think she was here in Perth, that when her baby sort of was born, you know, like when a baby's born, you're in hospital or in a home there, and the baby's on your chest, and the baby actually sat up, put its legs in full lotus, and sat in a meditation posture. Freaked her out. And just did it, no, it was only about 1 or 2 days old. This little baby actually sat in full lotus by itself. Now, see, I hear all these stories because people don't want to actually tell anybody else because they think that people think they're crazy. So that's obviously a baby who'd meditated before. Yeah?
They took a picture.
No, they didn't take a picture. You don't think about taking pictures at the time because especially it's on your chest. And it's the baby sat in lotus on mum's chest after a couple of days. Weird. Could you please explain the Eightfold Path? Thanks. You know the Eightfold Path, right? It's a whole talk to the whole Eightfold Path, but it's right view. In other words, some understanding about the Dhamma, about suffering, non-self, etc. And right intention, which means thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of kindness, thoughts of non-cruelty. It's what you're supposed to be doing when you're meditating. Thoughts of letting go, not trying to get jhanas or get stuff, but thoughts of abandoning everything. Thoughts of letting go. Thoughts of kindness, metta, and thoughts of non-cruelty. Don't be cruel to your mind or to yourself. And you've got the precepts, you know, right speech, right action, right livelihood. And then you've got sort of right efforts, the heroic ability to just abandon everything. And mindfulness and jhanas, the Eightfold Path. Ajahn, you have responded a number of times that everything is not caused by karma, but did not explain adequately. I've read in Buddhist literature what is called niyamas, i.e. bija niyama, chitta niyama, what's this, something or other, and dharma niyama and iretu niyama. Oh, okay, the hetu, that's the seasons. Is this Buddhist teaching or something added on later? It's added on later. This is not in the suttas. This idea of niyamas. It's from the Abhidharma. Thank you, Ajahn. It's been bothering me for some time. I thought of letting it go tonight. Yes, please let it go. Because you've got to keep it simple sometimes. And, you know, I like to keep it simple. If it's not the word of the Buddha, it's not really useful. Because this is one of the Buddha's teachings in the suttas. He took up a handful of simsapa leaves. Simsapa was a tree. And he asked the monks, he said, the handful of leaves which I'm holding here, is it more or less than all the leaves of this great forest? I said, obviously, the leaves in the forest are so much greater, the handful of leaves you're holding is just insignificant compared to all the leaves in the forest. He said, in the same way, monks, what I've told you compared to what I know is just like the small amount of leaves in my hand compared to the whole forest. But he said, the reason I haven't told you everything else is because it has nothing to do with enlightenment, nothing at all to do with the path. He said, all I've told you is all that's necessary for the path. So Graves was saying there, he's saying that what he didn't say because it has no relevance at all. The Dharma he did say is irrelevant. So what you have in the Buddha's teaching is all you need. What comes later, it just confuses the issue. Okay, next question coming up. Is that okay? Okay, here we go. Dear Ajahn, a thought of ill will suddenly come up into my mind, and it stayed on to disturb me. Oh, suddenly an insight arose that this thought is not me, not mine, not myself. What a relief it was to be able then to let it go. Thank you for your teaching and letting go. It's great, well done, because that's using your insight. Sometimes the ill will stays because you're bothered about it. You feel upset about it. Actually, you start to own your ill will. It's my ill will, then it's a big problem. Remember what I said, it's none of my business. If it's none of your business, doesn't belong to you, then you can let it go. No problem anymore. So it did very, very well. The thought of anger comes up, none of my business. So it just comes, and it doesn't find a place to hold on inside of you, so it just disappears again. If it finds a place to hold on, it grabs you, then it's got you. And one ill will get another piece of ill will, and the ill will just grow, just like a seedling. It finds a little niche or a cranny somewhere and puts its roots down, and it's got you. So if ill will comes, ill will goes, not me, not mine, not self, nothing to do with me, then it doesn't stay. Very good. When people remember past lives, were monks usually monks and lay people, are any recall past lives more villainous? Yes, maybe that you were one of those villains in the past. That's why some people don't want to watch their past lives, because they're afraid they might find out who they really were. You could have been a mass murderer in your past life. And that would be very, very awful to understand. You could have been Joseph Stalin in your last life, responsible for the murder of many, 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 many people. Or you could have been Elvis Presley in your last life, which is why you like it. Now, usually when people remember their past lives, it's ordinary Joes. Sorry? Not Rasputin. Yeah, the mad monk. Really, that might be me. No, there's usually some connection there, because your tendencies, inclinations usually go from life to life. That's why some of those past life memories, then Ian Stevenson's got the best collection of real past life stories. There's one guy who was reborn in Burma, and as a young man, he hated rice and curry. He always wanted bread and butter. And they traced it pretty quickly. He was like one of the English soldiers who died in some campaign in Burma and got reborn in the Burmese family. And he was completely different to, you know, other Burmese until he got to puberty, and then he started liking rice and curry and became a Burmese again. And it's always, it seems to be the case around puberty, actually you change. And even I don't mind saying that, you know, I don't know if he's remembered his past lives, but Ajahn Jiao's here at our monastery. When he first came, he just couldn't have enough of bread and butter. He loves bread and butter. And he's like a Thai monk who lives in a monastery. And so there's some parts of him you can see a Thai, especially now because he's, you know, way past puberty, but he's still got some Western characteristics. Speaks perfect English. So, who knows where you went in past life. But one of the most interesting past lives, or actually seeing a life, is this, which shows actually how you can get reborn from one type of being to another type of being. In one of these monasteries in Thailand, I won't say where it is, it's not what Ratnanachat, but the monk from this monastery has been visiting us many, many times. And as sometimes happens in Thai monasteries, if there's any animal in distress, they can usually dump it at the monastery. Now, please don't do that in our monastery. Just recently, people dumped two cats, so we've got three cats in our monastery now. But in this particular case, there was a monkey who they found in a cage who had been really mistreated by the owner. And so this Buddhist brought it and gave it into this monastery to look after. And of course, the abbot was very, very kind. And so I let the monkey out of the cage, you know, really cared for it, looked after it. And of course, the monkey became very devoted, especially to the abbot and also the other monks. But because it was hanging around the monks so often, that when the monks did something, the monkey had to do the same. And so it was very sweet. When it came like tea time, you had to give the monkey a cup of tea as well. And the monkey would sit there with its paws around the cup of tea, drinking its toops, drinking the tea, just like the monks. But the monkey, during the daytime, would hang out with the abbot. And when the abbot was receiving guests, especially like people from Bangkok, because he was, you know, getting quite well known, sometimes some of the people would be cheeky to the monk. You know, like sometimes, you know, you could be cheeky to me sometimes. But that's okay, I'm a Westerner, I don't care, because I'm cheeky back. But it wasn't really done to do that in Thailand, but sometimes it would be cheeky. And if the monkey saw anyone being cheeky to the abbot, he would do this time and time again. Go to the first person in the group and sit in their lap, and you could pet it. And it was like good fun to pet this really nice fluffy monkey. And then you go to the next person, and you could pet them. And then you go to the next person would pet it. So they all had to take a turn in petting it. When it got into the lap of the person who had been cheeky, it would bite them. You know, to say, you shouldn't be cheeky to, you know, this abbot, because, you know, he's my friend. And he'd apparently bitten so many of these people, because many were cheeky, that the abbot thought, no, you can't stay in this monastery. You know, one of these days he's going to bite, someone's going to get infected and be in big trouble. So he told the deputy abbot to take that monkey to a nature reserve, which was like an island in the middle of this big lake, which was still forested, so it was protected. So the deputy monk took the monkey, and the monkey was really depressed apparently the whole time. He knew what was going on. And they got a rowboat, rowed over to the island and let the monkey out. And the monkey just looked back, completely forlorn, really fed up. But that was the head monk's orders, and so they had to let the monkey go on this island to try and get back to nature. And about a week later, so the abbot, in his meditation, had an imita, a vision of this monkey. It was really suffering because it wasn't used to the wild and it wasn't surviving. So the abbot told the second monk, he said, look, we've punished the monkey enough, go back and get it and bring it back to our monastery. So the second in charge went back, got the car, went back to that lake, got the rowing boat and went to this, you know, huge nature reserve. And how do you find a monkey in this huge nature reserve? He just called out its name. And apparently, as soon as it called out its name, he heard sort of the trees rustling. Within a minute, this monkey, swinging from branch to branch, and just jumped right into the monk's lap. Just really sort of so happy that it saw its friends again. And then the monkey bit the monk. Just, don't do that again. But the deputy monk was under orders to actually bring it back to the monastery, so the monkey behaved afterwards, because he was very happy to be home, but, you know, don't leave me like that again. And they brought it back to the monastery, so it was back with its having its cups of tea, and sort of, you know, making sure the abbot was protected from cheeky people from Bangkok. But it was also, actually, it would chase the cars outside the monastery to try and keep it quiet. And one day it traced a truck and got killed. The truck ran it over. But the abbot was meditating at the time and apparently saw its dream of consciousness leave the body and go into the village. Because this was the local village where they went for alms round. He knew everybody there. And saw the stream of consciousness of the monkey enter the womb of a pregnant woman. He actually saw it and told everyone. Said, now the monkey's going to be reborn in that lady now. Because he saw it actually go inside the womb. And when that baby gave birth, he gave birth to a boy who was unnaturally hairy. It was a monkey reborn as a young boy. And I don't know what he's like at school, but I'm sure he will be a little monkey. So that was actually a very clear case of an animal, because it had been associated with people. And because it had been hanging around monks, it got some really good karma. And it thought it was a person. So it actually got reborn as one. That's where it thought it belonged. Yeah? Yeah. Very often, because especially dogs, they hang around human beings so much, and sometimes you give them human food. They won't eat sort of, you know, pal or whatever dog food you have. You know, they want, so if you have rice and curry, they want rice and curry as well. If you have fish and chips, they want fish and chips. And some dogs actually do that. They eat human food. And you give it to them. And they sort of, they go and watch, you know, the TV with you. So after a while, they become so human that they get reborn as a human. Because that's where they think they belong.
At what point do you get this to the new
No, it's really strange. It's usually just after conception at any time to just before the birth of the baby. So, you know, there's like a vacancy there. So like room for let. And so any time, you know, right at the very beginning, as soon as they put the sign up, room for let, or just before that, you know, they decide to demolish the house. That's what happens. Okay. You've got to use some analogy somehow for room for that. Okay, and that is the last question, except for the ones on enlightenment. So I've actually completed the questions tonight, and it is 9:30. So if you want to just try and see what it's like to be the horizontal being, make sure you don't die while you're in bed, otherwise you might get reborn as a horizontal being. And just have a nice evening. And tomorrow morning, another chanting at 6 o'clock, and another talk tomorrow will be probably the talk on the very, very deep insights on Anicca Dukkha Anatta. Coming up tomorrow. Something to look forward to tonight. Just like people apparently they look at the newspapers to see what's on TV tomorrow morning. This is on Channel Brahm tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. So have a nice evening. Hope you enjoyed. And thank you for all those people who wrote the questions. And see you tomorrow. Good night.